Welcome to the Omfer podcast.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is David Marsh from OnFIF. It's a great pleasure to welcome Philip Lane, who's the member of the board responsible for economics at the European Central Bank. He's really been at the ECB in a most engaging and active period for all the reasons you know about. Before that, he was the governor of the Central Bank of Ireland. And before that, he was a very distinguished economist and academic at Trinity College in Dublin. So one issue which you have raised a lot, you mentioned inflation. Do you accept that inflation is likely to be a bit higher next year than you've been so far predicting, the 1.6%? Because you seem to be moving towards ending the PEPP with 1.6% as your current forecast. On the other hand, there's been quite a few changes in the world economy since the 1.6 was promulgated. We've had this massive US stimulus program. We've got the vaccinations and so on coming on better in Europe than had been seen, likely to lead to a big increase in growth in the third quarter. And we also had Janet Yellen, the former head of the Fed, yesterday, now Treasury Secretary, talking about the Fed potentially tightening because there may be some overheating in the United States. Are you willing to say that your inflation forecast is actually more likely to come out much higher than the 1.6% for next year based on what is going on at the moment?
There's a lot packed in to that question. Many sub clauses in what you just said. It's been not very long ago did we do our March forecast. So let me go back to the March forecast. Now, in the March forecast, you know, we were aware of the vaccinations. You know, so the question is, compared to March, have we learned anything new about vaccinations? Have we learned anything new about the world economy? Have we learned anything new about the European economy in the kind of short number of weeks since the March forecast? Because a lot of those issues were already incorporated in the March forecast. So I think it's important always when we see news arrive, the question is the news simply confirming what we already had built in? So the fact that...
Sorry to interrupt, Philip. I'm pretty sure the American stimulus program wasn't fully built in because it hadn't all been fully legalized.
But let me get to what's in and what's not. So, but other elements like the fact that Europe is going to have a big acceleration in vaccinations in these weeks, that was built in. The fact that Europe is going to have a big unlocking of the economy in the coming weeks, that is built in. By the way, I should say, and I'd invite you to go back to the 1st of May, 2020, when the staff unrolled their initial post-pandemic forecasts. They were remarkably, the baseline has been remarkably robust. Back then, a year ago, the calculation was the medical solutions would be taking hold in mid-21, which is essentially what's happening. So I think we've for the all year long, we've based our kind of assessment, our projection on basically a baseline that essentially is coming to pass.
Yes, sorry to be a bit persistent, but the one thing that nobody knew clearly was the massive American stimulus, which is clearly huge change.
We did publish, to some extent it entered the forecast because, of course, that fiscal stimulus, entered the bond market, you know, pretty quickly. And we did publish, the staff published in the projections. They also said, well, here's what we think would be added on through the US fiscal stimulus. But it's important that when we go meeting to meeting, we say, okay, let's have our list. That's one element on the list. Another element on the list is the fact that the bond market has continued to move. So we would also have to take into account the latest update in terms of nominal yields. We would have to take into account what we our update on the world economy, which is not just the US. What we see in India is not good news, for example. And by and large, we have to update the global picture, which is not just the US picture. And then coming to the issue about inflation, it's very important to differentiate the near term from the medium term. I mean, I wrote a blog post a couple of weeks ago, which basically said a lot of the inflation surge this year is just unwinding the negative inflation shock last year. And if you average 2020 and 21 together, you'll get an average around 1%. And we do project when these various effects unwind, we will be in the low ones early next year. And in the March forecast, we do think inflation will pick up. And, you know, we were forecasting for 2023, a pickup in inflation, but only to about 1.4. So, and let me emphasize, inflation is mostly a domestic phenomenon. The fact that there's clearly a different macroeconomic configuration in the U.S., the deposits spill over to the world from the U.S., to the world economy. But the impact is limited by the kind of trade linkages. It's important not to read across too strongly.
Thank you, Philip. I think I get the message. I just want to ask one more question before I then go on to Alison Ryan, who's the first member of the panel, to ask you a question. But first of all, in your talk just now, you made this comment about inflation buffers and having a range actually would allow, therefore, different countries to also catch up in terms of competitiveness. Is that a coded way of saying that you would rather welcome the German inflation rate to be considerably above the average inflation rate, because that would indeed allow other countries which are less competitive than Germany to, if you like, catch up? We do see, as you know, a rise in the German inflation rate, which a lot of people may get quite hot and bothered about towards the end of the year, 3% and more, partly because of the domestic factors you mentioned. Is that a good thing that German inflation rate continues to be significantly above the euro area average? Would you actually recommend that?
Well, the point I was making is pretty universal, and it's also universally made 20 years ago, and no doubt before the euro as well, which is, regardless of the identities of which country is in what position at a given point in time, you know, as a universal principle, whatever condition requires real exchange rate adjustment in the euro area, if you accept, which I do, I think the evidence is overwhelming, that it is difficult, if not downward nominal wage adjustment. It does make the case for having a kind of a positive inflation buffer, an average inflation rate for the euro area, which is positive, greases the wheels. My kind of history as an international economist, would also say, look, when we think about real exchange rate adjustment, it's by and large, it's about relative labor costs, which is not the same as relative HICPs. So I'm not going to make the one-to-one mapping from the fact it might be different consumer inflation rates across Europe, to saying, is this one-to-one helping real exchange rate adjustment? And by the way, my own academic career, I've always emphasized that for any individual member country, its trade rate with real exchange rate is really dominated by the external value of the euro. We overstate the intra-euro area element versus the extra-euro area element.
We'll bear that in mind, definitely. Let's go on to the questions, since there's a whole host of them and we've only got half an hour left. Alistair Ryan.
Thank you. Good afternoon. It's a question on slide 4, really, the interaction between the boxes, monetary policy instruments, financial stability, the TLTRO, key tool for the ECB now, used to influence credit conditions, but with less and less effect bank by banks. I'm a banks analyst. What I can see is that the weaker the bank, the keener it is to use the TLTRO, the bigger the impact it has on the bank's behaviours, creating financial stability issues for the stronger banks. As the TLTROs are used more, they're more likely to be just redeposited back at the ECB, which is creating other financial distortions. So without a credit angle to the TLTRO, banks don't make riskier loans because they've got more liquidity. They're already awash with liquidity. It's becoming quite a difficult tool from banks' perspective. How do you think about the trade-offs within that, please? Thank you.
It's difficult to kind of... made a connection between your description and the way I think about it, or indeed what I read from the bank lending survey. So when we ask the banks themselves. So it's important to keep in mind the T in Telstra, that these are targeted, that it is essentially that the funding provided is conditioned on meeting credit targets. And, you know, in the heat of the crisis last year, the target was said, well, let's keep credit from contracting. Let's avoid a credit squeeze. So we do think in the bank-based system that we have in the euro area, that it and the fact, and especially in this round where we did cut the kind of a funding rate to below the deposit facility rate, that we've seen a huge take up. Now, so not every generation of Telstros have the same impact, but this generation of Telstros has, we think, a large impact. We think it's not only about today, but it's also about the next couple of years in terms of making sure banks are able to fund the recovery in investment that we anticipate. So actually, I mean, I do think everyone's views, our views, and maybe the outside world views of the role of Telstros probably will need to be updated after this round, because all monetary policy has a different effect depending on how stressed the world is, and also in terms of the kind of demand for credit situation. So we're quite optimistic that the current round of Telstros is proven effective. Let me say is that maybe unlike some previous generations, the take-up is extremely broad. So it's not the case that it's only banks who find it difficult to raise wholesale funding have tapped Telstros.
Good. Well, I'm going to cut you off there, if I may, because we've got a whole load of other questions. It sounds to me, Alison, you booked yourself on a flight to Frankfurt to have a teaching on Telstros with Philip. Could I ask Agnes to put your question now, please?
Yes, hello. I also have a question about instruments. You talked about reviewing the right balance of instruments at the ECB, and I'd like to ask your view about how to make the best of asset purchases, which have proved quite effective in this crisis and the past one. And in particular, would it make sense to you to maintain an active envelope of asset purchases, which may or not be used, while the ECB starts raising interest rates, to avoid a disorderly normalization of the yield curve?
Okay, that's an interesting question, because I mean, the usual hierarchy, and it's built into our forward guidance, is we will stop net purchasing before we raise interest rates. So there's a clear sequence, which again, I think is fairly global, that the historical kind of and it's really for the same logic as you have, but maybe in reverse, which is once start, you know, you do want to make sure you have an active monetary policy tool. So once you I do think it's important that you do have interest rates which have started to be raised, which allows you to make sure that you do have interest rate space after the end of net purchasing. So it's also true, as you know, we've seen with the Bank of England, the kind of sequencing between the end of purchasing and interest rates is going to be looked at or is being looked at. So, I mean, I think it is a topic where, you know, it's interesting to ask, is that traditional logic still robust? And I do think the starting point is robust. So the starting point, which is in our forward guidance, is to end net purchasing before liftoff. But philosophically, we should always be looking again at every topic. And as I say, I think the Bank of England has a study right now to look at that topic.
Yeah, I'm going to bring in another question who I know has got a question about asset purchases. But just as a prelude to that, Philip, regarding the PEPP, which you're on track, I think, to end that at the end of March next year. The idea behind the PEPP is to end it when the crisis engendered by the pandemic is over. Do you think that the health crisis may be over by then, but the economic crisis will still be going on, and that might be a reason to carry on with the PEPP? This is just a prelude to another question which is coming along in a moment.
Well, let me take that on. I mean, with the PEP, we did link it to the end of the coronavirus crisis phase. So it is very much connected to that. But as you indicated, we haven't, decided any kind of numerical rule for that. And I think we should be at this point, which is, and what we've said is end of March 22 or whenever the Governing Council concludes that the corona crisis phase is over. And I think it's important with this pandemic to focus on the here and now. This is a long way away, and that, we've essentially got our guidance or provided the guidance that during this pandemic, we're going to be guided by maintaining favorable financing conditions in the context of making sure that the pandemic shock to the inflation path is offset. So, I think, I can see, a lot of interest about what do you expect? And I think in the world we're living in with uncertainty, it's not super productive to focus on anyone's central expectation. As opposed to, the whole philosophy of PEP is let's be responsive to how the world unfolds. So I think rather than focus on kind of central expectations, we need to make sure that PEP does its job in terms of making sure that this pandemic is not amplified by a lack of accommodation.
Sorry to press you on this, but just before the next question, at what range, 2 months, 3 months, 2 weeks, at what range would you be willing to say? Because you say you have to concentrate on the here and now. So at what range of forecasting would you be happy to say, well, is this either going to end?
Oh, sure. No, at some point. At some point, of course, we will have to, and it's also not going to be the last day of March next year.
No, so 3 months.
But it's conditional on the pandemic. It is conditional on the pandemic, both in a narrow sense in terms of the spread of the virus and its containment, but also in terms of its impact on the economy.
I get your point. Let's go over to Emanuele. Manu, your question, please.
Thank you very much. So moving forward on Agnes and David's remark on the end of the PPP and looking forward at the inflation forecast, if we start looking beyond the PPP and start considering the APP as the remaining tool, and we look at the inflation forecast, you could imagine us being in a environment where more stimulus is needed to meet the inflation target. But with the APP limits, I was wondering how this will be possible, considering that you would require to do significant monetary stimulus to be able to reach that target. And the APP clearly has bond related limits as well as other limits. So would you consider changing them?
I mean, I think we try to be as clear as we can and in a very repetitive way that we stand ready to adjust all of our instruments in order to deliver the inflation aim. So I think, this is, I feel like a very common question I get asked, but I mean, the response in the end is we have a mandate. We have a mandate to deliver price stability. In our current formulation, in 03, that was clarified to be aiming for an inflation rate below but close to 2%. And essentially, in order to deliver that mandate, we have to provide the monetary accommodation needed. So, I think rather than it's important not to dwell on any particular detail of any particular program, because to repeat, we stand ready to adjust all of our instruments as appropriate to deliver that target. So, I do think that should be the guidance.
If I may, just to take up the thread of Benny's question, let's say you did decide to carry on because you, as you say, you can use all your instruments and you've got the mandate to follow. Let's say you did decide to have an instrument which didn't have the same limits as the APP. Would you be a bit worried that you might fall foul of the German Constitutional Court and the European Court of Justice, which indeed say that those limits are actually very important, and you've been allowed just to sidestep them for the emergency, but they may not be so lenient if you were to try to use an APP without limits, for example, in the future under this very discretionary policy that you have.
But again, I think it's important to make a couple of points. One is, of course, we operate within a legal framework, and we're crystal clear about the European Court of Justice and its various rulings. But what's also true in those rulings is the importance of recognizing we do have a mandate, a treaty mandate. So everything has to be in the context of what is proportionate and necessary to deliver that mandate. So that essentially is always true. We're always super careful. Every central bank, by the way, in the world cares about limits. They care about, you know, what fraction of the different bond markets that they're holding. So, you know, I think this issue in terms of the overall monetary policy stance, you should always put that into the context of everything else. We provide liquidity through TLTROs. We set the level of the short-term interest rate. We have our forward guidance. So, you know, I think if you look at the range of monetary policy instruments we have, it's very important to recognize that essentially
that's extremely clear. Because time is pressing on, let's go on to the next question. So this is Christian Kopf, please.
Yes, thank you, David, and welcome. Hello from Frankfurt. I think my video is not really starting.
No. Don't worry, we can hear you loud and clear.
Very good. Philip, under your stewardship, the ECB is putting a lot of pressure, a lot of emphasis on conditioning financial markets. Do you see a potential conflict between achieving market stability and preserving the resilience of financial markets?
I think, Christian, I'm going to have to ask you to elaborate a little bit. I mean, what do you have in mind in terms of the trade-offs or the tension?
Well, basically, the violence of the market sell-off in March may have been related to the drip feed of central bank buying in the month running up to the crisis, which has led to a loss of market discipline. Yeah. So in a way, by putting so much pressure on markets and by trying to achieve favorable financing conditions, you take away some of the market discipline, and that basically leads to the situation when something small happens, you get an outsized reaction of financial markets, which may run counter to your initial intentions.
Okay, now I more fully understand your question. So I think there's kind of some general issues there, and then there's the kind of specific issue of what happened last March, which of course was not only in the euro area. And of course, if we think about the US, they did not have an active QE program going into the pandemic. And of course, there was a very large shock to the US Treasury market. So in the particular context of the pandemic last March, and also, by the way, of course, throughout most of 2019, we were not net purchasers, although we'd started again in late 2019. So in the particular context of last year, I'm not so sure, but there is a general point which is relevant to raise, which is when central banks have a large footprint in the bond market, how does this alters the kind of incentives facing other participants? I mean, this goes back to the fact that we try not to be arbitrary. The reason why we do have this large footprint in the bond market is we do think it's necessary in order for the economy to recover from the crisis, that financial conditions are kept favorable. But maybe this is where the kind of line is drawn is we've also, you know, made clear, that, we're not doing yield curve control. We're not totally suppressing, long end market pricing. And of course, we do operate, within, limits. It's not the case that we're the dominant, purchaser, in the market. And we do want, bond market discipline, to play its role. So the question is, what is escapable and what is inescapable? You know, are there ways, you know, in, as we kind of execute what's necessary in terms of monetary accommodation? And what we do think, by the way, you know, and I would sign up to this, is we also have to think about the, macroprudential framework for non-banks, for the bond market and so on. Because of course, another narrative about what happened last March, maybe more in relation to money markets right on the long end, is whether the correct, framework was in place to encourage a little bit of self-insurance on the part of those involved, in the money markets and the bond markets.
Yes. Well, you've covered a lot of bases. That's a very good food for thought there, Philip. Lots of bases covered there. I've got another question now from Mr. Caillot, please, Jacques.
Hello. Thank you very much. Hi, David, Philip. The question is very much in the context of the recent literature, which has focused on the so-called lower for longer and make-up strategies. Could you give me your personal view on the make-up strategies, and in particular, those that relate to forward guidance, which would include some form of overshooting in the context of historically low inflation?
Okay, thank you. I mean, I think again, it's important to recognize what must be universally true versus what is relevant in the particular context of a particular monetary system at a particular point in time. So, I mean, I think it's hard, not to, fully agree, with the basic logic of when there is a lower bound, and when the equilibrium real interest rate is low, that the ability of central banks to quickly correct negative shocks is constrained. Whereas that's not true on the other side. You know, if you have a positive shock, there isn't the same technological constraint on the ability to tighten policy. So that is a fundamental asymmetry, which has to be recognized. I think it's probably a universal principle coming out of that. It is that a degree of patience is required as inflation pressure picks up, because it's not you know any kind of agent. So whether it's an investor, a firm, a household, in trying to work out where will inflation be in the future, we'll look at the evidence. And if the evidence is a repeated observation of low inflation, that will, you know, I think, and I think it's in the data, will influence beliefs about the future. And so the issue is, how do you convince or emphasize to everyone that is not the case, that there is a, even if there is a period of sustained low inflation, it remains the case the central bank wishes inflation to return to a higher number. And the issue of, you know, I think it's something that should be reflected in forward guidance, but the exact formulation, the exact role of any kind of overshooting principle, I think very much depends on the exact circumstances. So this is clearly something we are looking at and thinking about, but it's also the case, you know, I don't think we have drawn any conclusions at this point.
I know you're a bit reluctant to talk too much about the future, Philip, but how likely do you think we are going to get into an overshooting situation of a durable kind, let's say, over the next 18 months to 2 years?
I really don't see it. I just don't see it. And this is why, you know, it's important in the end. I do think a precondition for persistent inflation is a strong labor market. And so the fact that there might be some bottlenecks in some commodities, the fact that pricing power may have been rediscovered by some global firms, is not on its own enough to generate persistent inflation. You need a strong labor market. We do think the labor market is going to lag behind the overall recovery. We noticed the sectors which have been most hit by the pandemic are quite labor intensive. So it's important, like in the projections we had in March, even if we were projecting that GDP will come back to 2019 levels in Q2 next year, we don't have unemployment going back to 2019 levels until 2023. So yeah. I really think it's important to differentiate the kind of any relative price adjustment we're seeing right now.
And would the same go for the exchange rate? We had a question in from the audience about the exchange rate. Would that be also accorded a relatively low significance if the euro were to be weak against the dollar, for example? You wouldn't expect that to increase markedly the inflation throughput.
Well, I mean, we do think the exchange rate is important for the European economy. It's quite an open economy. So the exchange, we were talking at the very start of this session about what goes into our forecast. And of course, movements in the exchange rate are kind of material for our forecast. But the exchange rate, you know, has been, I would say number two, one has been relatively stable after a pretty significant surge. But the medium-term movement in the exchange rate matters for medium-term inflation. You know, by and large, we view the exchange rate as a random walk. So, you know, we don't think we have ability to predict future movements in the exchange rate. But the exchange rate movement that's already happened is an influence on the inflation dynamic. And if there are future moves, they will be an influence on the inflation dynamic.
Okay, well, thank you very much. We've got a question also from Catherine Bosley from Bloomberg. Catherine, please put your question. You don't necessarily have to switch on your video. I don't think it's working, but just put the question.
Sure. I just wanted to ask, obviously, you've talked a lot about the importance of the strategy review and especially for inflation. And I just wanted to ask, lots of people are expecting a big fireworks from the ECB in June. And I was wondering if that was a good bet or whether it might not be more sensible to wait until September when you would have the results of this review and more forecasts and just a better sense of where the pandemic is headed.
So I mean, going back to the issue, which I tried to emphasize earlier on, it is obviously it's relevant the calendar for PEP in terms of until the end of March 22 or with the Governing Council reserving its right to decide when the corona crisis phase is over. But it's important to go back to, in the meantime, the way we're running PEP is basically centered on a quarter by quarter assessment of the favorability of financing conditions, where favorability is essentially defined in the context of the inflation outlook. So it's important to recognize that this is, there's no reason to believe this is a linear process. That we stepped, you know, we basically over the course of PEP, we had a very high rate of purchasing last spring. That came down in the autumn and it was relatively low in the first couple of months of this year. And then we stepped up at the March meeting. But the whole philosophy of PEP is basically to be responsive in a flexible way to basically the two components, what's happening to the inflation outlook and what's happening to the financing conditions with a particular focus on market interest rates. And so, you know, the issue of what happens in June, what happens in September, what happens next December will turn on those. And whether that's a linear process or whether it's a process involving revisions on a quarter by quarter basis will be driven by this basic criterion of asking, are financing conditions favorable in the context of the inflation outlook? So, you know, okay. I think so it's important.
You've lowered the expectations of fireworks, I would say, Philip. Just on that, there's one or two questions I'd still like to get to, if I may, Philip. One is actually regarding what you've just been talking about. If you look at the figures, it seems as though the actual increase in your purchases under PEP in, say, April was just about 15 to 20% higher than some of the weekly rates in January, February, i.e. not that much of an increase. Are you still keeping up a very cautious approach here? You're buying about 80 billion a month. Your run rate is very much in line with what you'd need to do to maintain this program until the end of March and then stop it. And then what do you think about potential lowering of the purchases as we get towards March? We won't call it tapering. We'll just call it a slow diminution. Is that something that you'd like to prepare us for?
Well, I think, as I just told you, it all depends on two forces. One is what's happening to the inflation outlook quarter by quarter, and then what's happening to financing conditions. And, you know, I think that there's nothing magical to say both are going to move in reinforcing directions. They could move in opposite directions. So what needs to happen quarter by quarter, let's see. But it's been very important going back to last December is what we said is we do have an envelope. We expanded the envelope to 1850, but we basically subordinated that to this commitment to maintain favorable financing conditions. If less is needed, we will go lower. But equally, if more is needed, we can upwardly revise the envelope. So okay. I think it's important. I mean, this is a very important pivot in how QE works. Because traditionally, it was easy. I mean, both in our own history and in how other central banks operate, you could basically summarize QE by basically saying, how much are you buying and for how long? But what we have done is subordinated that to this favorability of financing conditions. So I do think the focus should not be on the kind of a volume-based approach, because we've essentially said we can go lower, we can go higher, and it should be focused on, I mean, it's basically the long-end version of how you might think about interest rate policy. Interest rate policy will be adjusted in line with the evolution of the economy, the evolution of the inflation outlook. And this is just the long-end version of that. We will, you know, be steering yields to our purchases in response to our updates on the inflation outlook.
Yes, it might be sort of as a three or maybe even four dimensional monetary policy. You could call it that. I've just got two questions left, if I may.
Sure.
One very interesting one from the audience, which I'll just put anonymously. And then I'd like to ask Christian Kopf to put on his video in a moment because he's got a very nice tie that he wants to show you. But the question from the audience is, you made some remark about monetary fiscal coordination. Would that extend, do you think, so says the question from the audience, to telling the euro finance ministers when they either have a too strong or too weak fiscal policy? Would that be part of what you could be doing? You could do it in a coded way, of course. You could do it in very polite language.
So I'm pretty sure what I refer to in talking about it was interdependence. So I think interdependence is blindly obvious. I did not say coordination. Because we have our independence, we have our mandate, and I do think it's important that we make our decisions and the finance ministers of Europe make their decisions. But we do say, I mean, we do say in our monetary policy statement, we do call on fiscal policy to play its role. So that is already there, essentially. We do highlight, and this was a high level way, you know, what we identify as desirabilities in terms of fiscal policy.
The governor of the Bank of England used to raise his eyebrows, and you can use the word role, can't you, in an imaginative way. So I do understand you have to be a little bit guarded here.
But I do think it's important, I mean, to recognize that, I mean, and every, pretty much all major central banks have legal independence. We're all in the same situation that the fact that we are recognizing and live in a world with high interdependence does not mean any requirement to coordinate policy.
Good. Okay, Christian, last question from Frankfurt.
Yes, thank you. On that note, Philip, are you concerned that the general public may care more about the risk of an overshooting of house prices than the risk of an inflation rate running slightly below the ECB's target, and that this concern may result in a change of your mandate, as we've seen in New Zealand?
So I think there's a related issue, but not the same. So, I mean, of course, the mandate of the ECB is in the treaty, so I leave it to others to think about whether any treaty change would happen. But what is true, and maybe I forgot to mention, is in our work on measuring inflation, we are looking again at this topic of whether the, you know, a very important part of everyone's consumption is housing, and whether what the current setup is really appropriate, and whether more weight should be given to owner-occupied housing in the inflation measures we look at. So, Christian, indirectly, or maybe more directly, depending on how you think about it, there is a relevant question of whether the inflation rate we are looking at should put a bigger weight on home ownership. But I would also emphasize is the issue about house prices, independently of consumer prices, is very much a topic for national macroprudential authorities, because it's not something that has a, you know, a perfectly correlated trend across the euro area. There's a lot of differences across countries, and we know macroprudential policy can play a big role. And of course, when as governor of the Central Bank of Ireland, that was one of our major tasks, was to make sure the macroprudential framework provided a lot of stability in terms of the housing system.
If I could just squeeze in a final one from the audience, since this has just come in, but it's very germane to what you were talking about, climate change. Are you willing to announce in September, when you come to the end of this, that you will take a fairly aggressive stance on the bond markets in terms of overriding market neutrality and deciding in your corporate bond purchases that you're going to set a certain set of standards for the bonds that you purchase in your program, those companies that do meet various climate change targets or do not over-emit carbon?
So, again, that question has so much going into it, it's hard to give a yes or no answer to that. What I would say, and I think it's a fairly widespread understanding now, is when we think about market neutrality, it's important to think about that question in a deep way. And of course, there's a certain logic to saying we're passive, we just buy what the market issues. But when you have a situation where the sectoral composition of the universal bond issuers is very different to the sectoral composition of the overall economy. So, of course, small firms, especially in the services sector, don't issue bonds. And when it turns out that the sectors that have the large firms, which are natural bond issuers, are also the sectors which have a very high rate of carbon emissions, then there is an issue we have to face. Exactly how we address that issue, let's see. But the kind of the logic of market neutrality, you know, let's define our terms there. You know, if the market of corporate bonds exactly reflected the composition of value added, you know, that's one basic asymmetry. And then the asymmetry connected to that is a deep asymmetry between the sectors who have a lot of emissions versus the sectors that don't. So there is an issue which we are currently looking at.
So it seems as though some kind of override might be expected, but let's wait and see. It is September, because you said very guardedly the second half of 2021, but I presume we can all go away thinking you are going to announce this in September.
Well, let me just repeat what President Lagarde said at the last press conference. Our deadline is the autumn. And if it turns out we solve all the problems before then, we let you know.
All right, good. Okay, well, thank you very much, Philip, for taking us all through that. You've been guarded in some of your responses, but because we've got to know your guardedness, even your guardedness does send a certain signal, a certain message. So thank you very much indeed for the signals. You are treading a quite narrow path in lots and lots of ways, as you've indicated. Thank you for being so patient and answering our questions, and we look forward to the next interaction. Perhaps it'll be a physical interaction rather than a virtual one.
Sure. Very good. Thank you, David.
All the best. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.